Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. If you're like most people, you've probably started thinking already about the traditional foods you'll eat this week at Thanksgiving dinner. As many of us learned in elementary school, the holiday is based on a three-day harvest feast held back in 1621. No one knows for certain what exactly was on the table at that first meal, but two eyewitness accounts mention venison, wild fowl, lobsters, eels, mussels, grapes, plums, and corn. What's conspicuously not mentioned are some of the foods we now consider Thanksgiving staples, such as sweetened cranberry sauce, potatoes, and pumpkin pie. Turkey is mentioned, but its prominence at that first meal is a little doubtful. So how did these foods make their way into our traditional Thanksgiving dinner? And how else has the holiday meal evolved over time? Joining our Thanksgiving menu conversation today, first, Marcia Vanderlip is the food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune. Welcome to our conversation, Marcia Vanderlip.
Thank you for inviting me.
Glad to have you with us at the table today. Also with us at the table, Trey Quinlan is the chef and owner of Trey Bistro in Columbia. He studied at the Culinary Institute of America in upstate New York and has worked in restaurants throughout New England and the Republic of Ireland. Welcome to our table, Trey Quinlan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you with us. On the phone, we are hoping to hear from Sandy Oliver. She's a food historian and co-author of the book Giving Thanks, Thanksgiving Recipes from Pilgrims to Pumpkin Pie. She is going to join us from her home in Maine a little later. But in the meantime, we also have on the phone Carol Fisher. She is the author of the American Cookbook, A History. She also co-wrote the book Pot Roast, Politics, and Ants in the Pantry, Missouri's Cookbook History. She joins us today by phone from her home in southeastern Missouri. Welcome, Carol Fisher.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that those of you listening in our audience will be part of the conversation too. What are some of your own unique food traditions around Thanksgiving? We'd love to hear what you do in your home. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet at us. So our handle is @intersectkbia. We're going to start with this question. Carol, maybe you can help us with this. What do you think the food was like at that first meal back in 1621?
In 1621, well, I would assume it would have been roasted over an open fire.
Over an open fire, right. Sandy, you are with us as well, right?
I am.
Fantastic. That first meal in 1621 that we now think of as the start of Thanksgiving, what do you think the food was like back then?
It was probably pretty straightforward. Roasted venison, for sure. Stewed almost anything else. Lots of fowl, that is waterfowl, various sorts. Possibly roasted, sometimes made into little dishes that we'd look at and say, well, that's like a casserole.
Right. Trey, as a chef, what would it be like to have to cook everything over an open fire?
It'd be amazing. I mean, the Native Americans were the ones that really, you know, started barbecuing and, you know, the open roast and flavors. The smoke gives tremendous flavors. Smoked lobster, smoked venison. Mm. Just sounds so wonderful as it is. And plus, they were starving to begin with, so I'm sure they enjoyed everything.
Right. But what about, you know, Thanksgiving? I mean, if you tried to cook a Thanksgiving meal entirely over an open flame, that would be a much different thing than what we have now, right?
Well, if you try to cook things today, like casseroles, you know, mashed potatoes, stuff like that, it would be very, very hard. But, you know, they were just, you know, putting things on spigots and roasting things and, you know, just doing kind of simple pots, you know. So it wouldn't have been too difficult. You know, they managed to get by at a very early time before they had the same, you know, things that we have.
Right.
So, you know, I think they handled it pretty well.
Yeah. Sandy, what else can you...
Can I... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say,
please.
I've cooked several Thanksgiving dinners over an open fire and an open hearth, and I actually found it wasn't all that hard to do.
Right. So what did you do? How did you make it work?
Well, first of all, you do put your turkey on a spit, and you set that down in front of the fire. Then you know, the things like the potatoes and the squash can be put in boiling pot, hung over the fire from a crane. Things like the cranberry sauce, you put those in little saucepans, and you put them on top of a little pile of coals down hearth where they kind of bubble away. That's where you do your gravy. Pies were baked in ovens the day before or 2 or 3 days before.
I have a question.
It's actually pretty easy to do. A hearth is wide, sometimes deep. You can really spread yourself around. Make little piles of coals here and there.
Right. Marcia, what do you think of that?
I was just going to ask you about the turkey because we tried the turkey on the spit a couple Thanksgivings ago, and the white meat got kind of dry. It was harder. It seemed like it was harder to evenly cook the turkey. How did your turkey come out?
It all depends on the turkey.
Yeah. Yeah.
These modern big-breasted white meat turkeys do dry out.
Yeah.
The turkeys folks were roasting in previous times, 200 or more years ago, were more like heirloom birds. And I don't know if you've ever used any of these heirloom birds.
Yeah.
Have you ever cooked an heirloom bird?
Maybe that's why.
Sandy, we're going to Sandy, just real fast, we're going to try to
have more dark meat on them.
Right.
Yeah. Sandy, I want to stop you for just a sec. We're going to try to clean up your audio connection because we're getting a lot of static in there.
Oh, okay.
And we're going to bring you back online in just a second.
Okay.
In the meantime, Marcia, what do you think your readers would say if you recommended cooking an entire Thanksgiving dinner over an open flame?
I mean, I have such a mixed group of readers. I'm sure some folks might think it's great. I know that there's a lot of Dutch oven folks out there that like to cook over fire in a Dutch oven. You could probably do that with a lot of dishes. I went searching for a heritage bird 1 year and cooked a heritage bird and recommended people do that. That's not really always the best. I mean, I think it's a great idea. I think it's just hard for folks who are really used to the traditional turkeys because the meat's different.
Yeah.
And Trey will probably attest to that as well.
I mean, if you ever go camping, I mean, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what Boy Scouts do, you know, every weekend.
Right.
I think for a turkey, though, the best way to cook it evenly is to go ahead and separate the legs from the breast and kind of like, you know, break it down like that. That way you can take it because, you know, to cook the legs to the same internal temperature as the breast, one of them's definitely going to be dry.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
There's always gravy.
Yeah.
Carol, I'm curious your thoughts in terms of the way that we cook the turkey and how that might have evolved.
Well, I think technology, is one of the big things that has changed how we cook our foods, obviously. You know, people don't have a hearth in their kitchen. They're going to be using their wood cook stoves, and they're going to be using their gas and electric. You know, I think that has changed it significantly.
Right. Okay, let me remind everyone that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner today. We are talking turkey and stuffing and pumpkin pie and finding out how we came to eat the foods that we do on Thanksgiving. Joining me in the studio are Marcia Vanderlip, the food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, and Trey Quinlan, chef and owner of Trey Bistro in Columbia. Also on the phone, we have Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher, both of them authors of books about the history of food. For those of you in our audience, are there things that you add to your Thanksgiving table that may not be all that traditional? We'd love to hear what you do. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet at us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 on KBIA. To watch that video and join our online chat room, just go to kbia.org, then scroll down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2, online at kbia.org. Sandy, I'm hoping you can take us back a little bit. We talked at the beginning of the program about the menu that happened in 1621, and it sounded a lot different from where we are today. So how did that happen?
You mean how did the original menu happen?
Yeah, how did that happen, and how did we wind up so far from that?
Yeah, okay. Happy to talk about that.
The first menu, of course, depended on what was available locally and what the pilgrims, as we call them, were able to grow that first season that they had established their colony in Plymouth. So the governor sent people out to shoot fowl, and they do not specify what source, but we can guess that probably there was some turkey involved. And then the Wampanoag came, at first because they didn't know why these people were making the noise that they were with guns. The governor said everybody could go out and do some target shooting, made a lot of racket. Native Americans said, what in heaven's name is going on? They massed together 90 people and visited. And when they realized that actually what was going on was a party, the chief, Massasoit, sent his men out to come back with five deer. So they had venison. That's what we know about the meal. Everything else would have been just whatever the pilgrims would have grown that season or were able to harvest as they, you know, gather from the wild.
How do we
get to green bean casserole and mashed potatoes? Would you like to know about that?
Well, I think Carol wanted to jump in there for a second,
right.
And then we'll come back to that transformation.
Right. I think it's all relative. What Sandy said was true. They had what was available. And as you go through our culture, our food culture, we have what's available. You know, we have green bean casseroles, like she was saying. You know, and I think that's what it is. We're in a way, we're not that far off in that we are using what's available.
Yeah. Well, let me ask this question about the venison. I mean, that's readily available in Missouri. Lots of people have deer as part of their diet here. Why is that not part of our Thanksgiving meal? Sandy, I'll throw that to you.
Well, venison really ends up being a fall product because of hunting season. Hunting is pretty well governed. You know, it's got all kinds of rules and regulations around it. But, the turkey thing really has to do with the fact that turkey was a very fashionable bird. In the 19th century, when the modern meal that we eat today really solidifies. You know, up to the early 1800s, Thanksgiving dinner consisted of lots of different dishes of food. Might have pork and chicken, goose, as well as seasonal vegetables. But in the 19th century, all during the 1800s, turkey was a pretty fashionable little item. It was a new world bird. It went to Europe, was domesticated, was returned to America. It was laden with a certain level of status in the 19th century. And then because Victorian Americans were very busy mythologizing their pilgrim forebears, the turkey, besides being fashionable and popular at the time and domesticated, easy to acquire because you could just grow it in your barnyard, they were doing a little bit of, identifying with the pilgrims. They would say, well, surely the pilgrims must have had turkey on that first Thanksgiving, and so we do too, and so we're like the pilgrims. So those two things kind of come together to create turkey as a centerpiece feature of Thanksgiving dinner.
Okay. Don't you think that, Sandy, that Sarah Hale with her magazine being, the Gaudy's Ladies book and promoting Thanksgiving in November and her issues with Thanksgiving menus had an effect on popularizing the types of things we do today for our Thanksgiving meals?
She was reflecting established practice, actually.
Yeah.
But,
She
was looking all around. This was the menu she grew up with, and most of the women her age did, too. So she wrote down the menu that she knew. She may have added a few little wrinkles, insisted on a certain way of presenting. She was sort of a Martha Stewart of the 19th century,
right.
I think. She's promoting this meal as the traditional thing based on it. It's essentially a New England seasonal local dinner.
Right.
But it was one she knew
right.
And all her life. And so she was busy trying to codify
her personal experience, I think.
I want to come back to the popularization that happened in the 1800s. But before that, we have a caller on the line, and I'd like to bring her into the conversation if we could. Mallory from Columbia, are you with us?
I am.
Great. Thanks for listening and for calling into our program today.
Thank you. My question is, do any of the contributors on the show today have noodles at their Thanksgiving dinners? My family never did, and then when I married my husband, his family must have noodles at the Thanksgiving meal, and I think it's kind of different and a little strange, and I just wondered where that came from.
How do you do your noodles? This is Carol.
They are handmade noodles, and it's sort of like they're in a chicken gravy, kind of. Yeah.
Marcia, have you heard of this?
Well, I do have Jewish friends who like to bring noodle dishes to the Thanksgiving table, and because Thanksgiving falls on Hanukkah this year, I guess this would be a perfect time to bring noodles to the table.
I guess it's definitely not Kugel-like, yeah. And they're definitely not Jewish.
They're not.
No, and they're from, you know, like Macon, Missouri, and my family's from St. Louis, and... I don't know where it comes from, but then I have heard of a few other people having that at their Thanksgiving meal.
And they're making their own noodles, too.
They are. They're sort of like...
Are they egg noodles?
Yeah.
Yes.
Egg noodles. Yeah. You know, sometimes it's a dish that some grandma makes and some kid requests, and the tradition gets started, and there you go.
but none of you have noodles at your Thanksgiving?
No.
Nope.
Well, I don't feel so strange.
No. It's kind of common, and I know I have a lot of, you know, family from Crane, Missouri, and around Springfield. They do like beef and noodles and stuff, egg noodles, and they usually actually do the day after with the leftover turkey, noodle, and it's kind of like that, just a simple, you know, egg, you know, heavy egg noodle with just like turkey, like Florentine sauce. Mm. You know, they pulled in like just some spinach, but nothing too fancy.
The really fascinating thing here is how a marriage can introduce something different to the table. This happens a fair amount, actually. And ask your mother-in-law. Ask your grandmother-in-law you're having noodles.
I've asked before, and I think it is kind of it just became popular. I've heard them say it's a Southern thing, which also doesn't make sense since they're not really from the South, but they also serve a really weird cranberry concoction that I also don't understand. It has, like, whipped cream in it.
Oh, ambrosia salad. Ambrosia salad.
You can imagine that the first Thanksgiving I was a little baffled at the dinner table.
That sounds like a very Southern Midwestern, traditional feast, egg noodles, ambrosia salad. Yeah.
I have a really good friend who always likes to bring us a type of a Jell-O salad to this Thanksgiving, and she's from Kansas City area. And that's what her mom was raised on. That's what they always had for Thanksgiving.
I'm always really happy if I get to bring the cranberry dish.
Cool. Well, Mallory, thank you so much for calling in today and for joining our conversation.
Have a lovely Thanksgiving.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so let me just remind everyone that you can call in, too. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Our number is 573-882-8925. I'm Reuben Stern. I'm filling in for Ryan Pamuliner today. And we are talking turkey and stuffing and pumpkin pie and exploring how the traditional Thanksgiving meal has evolved over time. Joining me in the studio are Marcia Vanderlip, food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, and Trey Quinlan, chef and owner of Trey Bistro in Columbia. On the phone, we also have Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher. Both of them are authors who have written books about the history of food. For those of you in our audience, what part of the Thanksgiving meal could you not do without? We'd love to hear what is essential in a Thanksgiving meal for you. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @intersectKBIA. This would probably be a good time for us to go back and talk about how some of those foods wound up in our traditional Thanksgiving meal. And Sandy, I wonder if we could talk about that. Earlier in the conversation, we mentioned the 1800s as a pivotal moment for Thanksgiving and our food traditions. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about what went on in that era that created what we think of as Thanksgiving today.
Sure. I would have to say that what went on was sort of a subtraction somewhat from what happened before. So in the 1600s and the 1700s, a celebratory meal probably featured a half a dozen different dishes all on the table at the same time. It could have included apple pie, minced meat pie, the turkey, a roast of pork, for example, along with seasonal vegetables. But in the ninth, and all the sweets and the savories would very likely have been mixed together on the table. We didn't separate out the sweet dishes and tack them on the end of the meal in the 1700s. But in the early 1800s, the sweets migrate to the dessert place that we know today, and the menu gets a little bit simpler. We like to have the featured roast, which is the turkey, and then some sides as well. The meal takes on its modern form in the 1800s. More vegetables, pickles, and then all of the pies, the apple pie, minced meat, pumpkin pie, all saved for after the main course has been eaten and cleared away.
Right.
And that gets pretty well locked in. But even by the middle, even in the middle 1800s, people were still putting a chicken pie on the table, maybe a couple of other roasts, just to make sure there was enough for everybody to eat. Then, as families get a little smaller, stuff falls away. Right. And at the very end of the 1800s, we start seeing introductions to the meal from more manufactured food and food from the South as well. And once the Southerners get involved, we end up with sweet potatoes and cornbread dressing and pecan pie. I mean, the meal really gets embellished with some really wonderful things.
Right. Now, Carol, you mentioned Sarah Josepha Hale in the mix here in the middle of the 1800s, and I wonder if you could explain a little more about the significance of her.
Well, yes, this is Carol. I think that her magazine that she edited was very popular, and, women like today like to look at recipes, and I think that, that's the influence she had on you. Like Sandy said, she was kind of like the Martha Stewart.
Right.
For that time period.
Now, she was in Philadelphia, right?
I'm letting you, Sandy, is that right?
Somewhere in the north,
I
guess.
Remember.
Oh, yeah.
So how did these southern things wind up proliferating across the country if we have these magazines that come from the north?
Practice. Just what people decide to do. If you're having a celebratory meal, you're going to put on the table the things that you think you need to have to celebrate with. Interestingly enough, in our more recent history, some immigrants moving to America discovered that Americans think lasagna is a very special dish, and there's at least one family I've heard about that always puts lasagna on the table because they want to show how American they are. So lasagna for Thanksgiving along with the turkey.
Yeah, I remember a Thanksgiving recently where there was kimchi on the table because it was a Thanksgiving with a lot of Korean friends.
Yeah.
See, there you go.
Right. Marcia?
There are plenty of Mexican influences for Thanksgiving, I would think, too. And we've done a little bit of that, too. You were talking about, I was thinking about the Northwest influence. My husband is from the Northwest, and he wants to do, he saw Bobby Flay on TV put cedar wood underneath the turkey, and so he's decided to try that this year and to see whether he gets that Northwestern smoky flavor. But there are so many regions, that, I suppose, in the United States where it's celebrated in different ways. And I think we take on, we always have pecan pie, and sweet potatoes.
And everyone just gets tired of eating the same thing done the same way.
Right.
So, and I think the reason why Southern became, so popularized was because, the spice route, I think, really intrigues people. So you see people going to Southern, tricks and recipes just to get out of that routine.
spice it up a little.
Yeah,
bit.
Like Emerald Lagasse could definitely help, you know, bam. Take it up a notch.
Okay, we have another caller on the phone. Lindsay from Columbia is on the phone with us. Lindsay, are you there?
I am.
Great, thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
Well, thanks for having me. Marcia, yeah. I love your column and your food section.
Oh, thank you.
So, Lindsay, you have some family traditions to share.
Yeah, I mean, this, when somebody, one of the speakers was talking about this mixture of savory and sweet, and my family has we serve cranberry sherbet as a sort of a palate cleanser at the beginning of the meal.
Wow.
Yeah,
that
and
sounds
it's
so
homemade.
Good.
I mean, my mom cooks down cranberries, and I've never made it, but it involves gelatin and lots of sugar and freezing and beating. And, I mean, this has been, you know, a tradition for decades. I don't really know, even like the previous caller, I don't know how it started. But I've also never met anybody who has cranberry sherbet at the beginning of Thanksgiving dinner.
You gotta do that at the
restaurant. Ideas for the restaurant.
That's
here.
Yeah.
Nice palate cleanser.
See if you can get the recipe, please.
Yeah. That sounds good. Yeah, I can send it over.
Actually, right. if you can email it to us, we will make it available on our website.
I will do that, you know, and that will make my mom really happy because I think sometimes she's like, why do I do this? On top of everything else, you know, she's beating this cranberry pulp and stuff. But anyway, it's a fun tradition. And thanks a lot for your show. This is just right for the holiday week.
Awesome. Well, thanks for calling in and for sharing your recipe and ideas with us.
I will. So would I just intersection@kbia.org?
Intersection@kbia.org. Yep.
I'll send it over.
Terrific. And, you know, we will post all the recipes we get. So if you're listening and you have a Thanksgiving recipe you want to share, we'll put that on our website too. So feel free to email those in. Trey, I just want to ask you, you know, these kind of playing with traditions, mm-hmm. What you're a chef. What do they teach you about that?
Well, they teach you the basics, and then, you know, you always want to challenge it, you know. You see a lot of things where they, you know, decompose dishes and then rebuild them in different ways, trying to be as creative possible. One of the best Thanksgivings I had was when I was going to the Culinary Institute of America, and we were on Thanksgiving break, so we went down to New York City and joined a couple friends. It was all these cooks, you know, trying to, you know, take their dish and outdo each other. So, you know, we had roasted parsnips, Brussels sprouts, pancetta, carrots all in one. We had a sweet potato filet with house-made marshmallows that we, you know, bruleed. And, you know, the turkey was brined in this pear cider for a couple of days and was just, and then made the best pan gravy. So, oh man, it's fun. You get tired of eating the same things, the variations. So just taking something and just playing one dish and, you know, changing it around makes it fun and very creative.
And what are you playing with these days? Like this year, what are you going to fool around with?
Well, I don't necessarily commit myself to cooking any of the dishes because I usually end up cooking all of the dishes, helping people finishing them. You know, I think trying to do some of the classic dishes, you know, roasted Brussels sprouts, mashed potatoes, sweet potato casserole, I think we're going to stick the traditional route.
Okay, I need to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. Today we're talking turkey and stuffing and pumpkin pie and learning how the Thanksgiving meal has evolved over time. Joining me in the studio, we have Marcia Vanderlip, food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, Trey Quinlan, chef and owner of Trey Bistro. Also on the phone, we have Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher, authors and historians of food. And we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back, and we hope that you'll stick around and join our conversation. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Femuliner. Today we're talking about the Thanksgiving meal, how we came to eat the things we do, and how that menu continues to evolve over time. Joining me in the studio are Marcia Vanderlip, food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, Trey Quinlan, chef and owner of Trey Bistro here in Columbia. Also on the phone, we have Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher, both of them authors of books about the history of food and recipes. For those of you in our audience, are there things about the typical Thanksgiving menu that you would like to see changed or added? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @intersectkbia. We also have an online chat going at kbia.org if you follow the link for Intersection. Feel free to email us your recipes as well. We'll make those available to folks after our show today. Over the break, we were talking a little bit about those family recipes. And Trey, you were talking about your family and their approach to Thanksgiving.
Yes. You know, my grandmother still has that index box of handwritten recipes that, you know, still to this day cannot be altered. That's why every year it's the same traditional, you know, Thanksgiving for, you know, for myself. You know, maybe one day we'll be able to get rid of update that index box. But yeah, they're at least, you know, 50 years old, so.
Yeah. Carol, I want to ask you about this because you've looked at a lot of old recipes, right?
Right.
So what changes over time in terms of recipes and what doesn't change?
Well, I think what changes is the way we cook, like we've talked about, the way we cook, ingredients available, you know. I think that's one thing that's changed. I think we're using recipes more, you know, with more specific directions. Because, you know, how many people do you know that would know how to make a pumpkin pie?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that one thing we're having to do is more specific recipes.
So did the old recipes not have that? Were they just a list of ingredients or what?
A lot of times they were a list of ingredients with just minimal instructions, process instructions. Mm-hmm. Because they made these things every day. Now, probably they didn't cook a turkey every day, but you know, how they did their sides, they probably did them. And, you know, there are a lot of people who are, who need more specific recipes, especially if we're getting venturesome, like the chef mentioned. You know, we have to become more familiar with spices available. And I think people are trying new things. I think the Food Network, you know, the TV food, I think it's kind of maybe inspiring people to try some new spices, to try some new flavors.
And do you think, is it your sense, maybe Marcia, you're the person to ask this question to, is it your sense that Thanksgiving is a place where people want to experiment with new things, or do people want the exact same pie every year?
I would be careful with that, because I think Thanksgiving would not be the day where I would experiment, because it's the day when everyone, I mean, if I messed with certain things, my kids would really be upset. You know, my husband does most of Thanksgiving dinner, and I'm the sous chef, basically. And it's been that way since we've been married. And he changes things up once in a while. But, I mean, we've had a bit of a revolt, you know, at least twice. You know, and it's with the kids. It's not with the older folks. Because it's what they expect. It's once a year. They expect that, you know, the dressing to be, it has to have the chestnuts in it. You know, the green bean casserole, it is made from scratch. But they really want it. You know, he's changing it up this year at risk, because we have someone who doesn't like mushrooms coming to the table, but he's going to put onions in instead. So I'm crossing my fingers that everyone goes for that. But yeah, I think it's good to change things up, but not everything. Certain things are kind of sacred at Thanksgiving, and it's a family event.
People get real fussy about their food. You know, if you switch things around on them, I mean, these people have been waiting a year for this dish.
Although, I know that food editors and probably other folks, you know, always feel like every Thanksgiving, oh, I have to come up with something new. And I get all the food mags and they say, 12 different ways you can, you know, make the turkey this year, you know, ways to change up your sides and all of that. And I think that's great, but you know, if you're the cook, it's always good to practice first.
Sandy, I'm curious your thoughts on this question of traditional foods versus the evolution of them.
Sure. I'd like to talk about that, because one of the great charms in my mind
to Thanksgiving is that this is the one day in the year when you can sit down to your meal and be fairly well assured that, you know, millions of other people are sitting down at this very same time and eating the same thing. And I think we don't get very many moments of national unity like that. This menu crosses party lines, economic lines, all kinds of things. So this is, you know, a wonderful opportunity to share something that we just don't share any other day of the year. But, you know, I don't feel compelled to come up with anything new or different. I only eat Thanksgiving dinner on Thanksgiving. I rarely ever replicate this menu any other day of the year. So if I want to change things around, I'll do it the day after Thanksgiving or a month before or some other time. But, you know, why mess with the Thanksgiving menu?
Yeah,
and
Marcia.
I would like to interject that I really agree with that, but I also love having the guests bring their own traditions into the home, and we have a lot of different things that usually come in to go with the Thanksgiving dinner, and that's fun too because
it's like the first Thanksgiving, right?
Or like the mythology,
the mythology, right? And it's fun, and then you know, lots of wild things come, and some things are not so good, and some things are, but everybody tastes everything.
right.
Carol, could I interject?
Yes, please do, Carol.
Okay. You know, I think the place where you go is important. We traditionally went to my mother's house for Thanksgiving for a very traditional dinner. And after she passed away, I'm the youngest of six children and bunches of grandchildren and grandchildren. And the quandary was what to do then, where to go. And so we tried one thing. I think it was the Thanksgiving after, we went to the Bass Pro Shop for the Thanksgiving dinner, which the food was good, but the grandkids revolted. And they said, we have to have Thanksgiving in a home.
Lovely. This is Sandy. I agree. There may be somebody who doesn't want to be at home for Thanksgiving or with friends or anything, but I think it's a bit of an imposition to ask people to work on Thanksgiving. If they had an alternative, they should be able to do it.
Right. We have a caller on the line. Another member of our audience from Columbia, Julie, is with us. Julie, are you there?
I am.
Great. Thanks for joining our conversation today.
Well, I'm thrilled because I'm hoping that someone somehow might hear this and be able to produce a recipe for this amazing dish that my grandmother always served at Thanksgiving. And your caller who mentioned a cranberry sherbet was on the same track. My grandmother, for many meals, but particularly for Thanksgiving, would make an ice. And that's what you would call it, an ice. And I think now it's more like what you would call a granita. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But she would make this ice out of all kinds of different ingredients, but at Thanksgiving, it was cranberry ice, and it was made out of cranberries, sugar. It wasn't a sherbet. It didn't have any milk in it. Cranberries, sugar, orange rind. It was kind of what you would think of as cranberry sauce, except it was frozen, and it was part of, it was one, it wasn't dessert. It was in between different courses, and it was absolutely delicious.
Granita.
Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, Trey, how do you interpret that?
It's a sorbet or a granita, basically. The difference is, it was probably a granita if she did it in house. You just make a simple syrup, add the flavorful ingredients that, you know, the cranberry juice, you know, all of it, and then put it in the freezer, and then you just gradually, at like 10, 15 minutes, stir it out with a fork, and then, you know, keep going back.
That's it. Okay. Is she Italian?
Although my paternal grandparents were Italian immigrants, and the only thing I can think is she would love to cook, and she was inventive, too, in the kitchen. The only thing I can think of is that the community that she lived in, there was also a large Italian immigrant population, and she may have just decided to do this, but it was so good. And I kind of miss having something cold
other than a beverage in the meal. It was a really nice contrast to all the other foods.
Yeah. Well, Julie, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yes.
And
thanks for the show.
Yeah.
Have a happy and flavorful Thanksgiving.
Thanks. You too. Sandy, I think you know this granita or ice, as Julie called it, raises a question that you know we've sort of hinted at a little bit, is the idea of the immigrant influence. You know, Thanksgiving is this all-American thing, and yet all-American means people who came from somewhere else for the most part, aside from, you know, the Native American side of the Thanksgiving meal, which we haven't really based the holiday on. So I just wonder if we could talk a little bit about that in terms of how, you know, the waves of immigrants in the country have affected what we eat as well, or not.
This is Sandy. Can I say one thing quickly about that ice?
Yeah.
Because, actually, George Josepha Hale would have known ices and probably made them. They were a very, very elegant touch to a Thanksgiving dinner, and probably only done by more elite families. And this would not necessarily have been an Italian influence, but it may have come to us by way of the French, the high-style French cookery.
Yeah.
So,
And how would that have worked in the 1800s before they had mass proliferation of
refrigeration? Oh, how did they make it?
Refrigeration,
oh, well,
yeah. Where would that come from?
Ice. You harvest ice off ponds, put them in storehouses with sawdust to keep them cold. And that's why this was an elite dish. Not everybody could go around building an ice house. Jefferson had one. Lots of the elite had these houses. So, you know, they would just chip off bits of ice and put it in a bucket and put the freezer unit, which is made of pewter or tin or something, into the ice, allow the ice to form on the inside of that container. They would scrape it down, return it to the bucket of ice, and so on. So it was, and it was most often served between courses.
Right, right. What about the immigrant thing? You know, the question of to what extent do we owe some of the things that are traditional to the various waves of immigration that have come in?
Can't think of a one.
Really?
Well, I mean, not, you know, if you look at your basic Thanksgiving dinner, you know, your turkey, your mashed potatoes, your gravy, cranberries, blah, 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 all that stuff. What you need to do is visit individual immigrant households and see what spin they put on it. So, for example, a family with Asian roots is very likely to stuff their turkey with rice, and they're likely to use, I know of a family that seasons their rice with Thai seasonings. They put that inside the turkey.
Right.
For example.
I guess the question then would be the opposite question of, you know, we've had so much immigration in the country, why hasn't it influenced the basic menu?
Because Thanksgiving is an American holiday, and if you want to show you're becoming an American, you eat an American menu for that day. You might, you know, do as this family did with the rice stuffing, but essentially you're going to perform as an American that day. In fact, that's how you show you've, you know, arrived in America.
Right.
There's a little sort of a dark side to all of this. A lot of the children of immigrants who came to this country in the late 1800s, early 1900s, were basically indoctrinated at school about, you know, what a real Thanksgiving in America was like. And they would go home to their families and they would say, well, you know, on Thanksgiving we have to have a turkey. And the mother would say, you know, what do we have to have a turkey for? We can make a perfectly good lasagna, you know. The kid said, no, Ma, you know. So it becomes a way of turning people who might not feel as American as someone might wish, but to turn them into an American by filling them up with mashed potatoes and gravy on Thanksgiving Day.
And was that Sarah Hale's intention?
No, I don't think so. She just really wanted some president to make this into a national holiday. She was lobbying presidents before Lincoln to declare a national holiday. It was a de facto national holiday. Individual states declared Thanksgiving annually year after year after year, but it was never a federal holiday.
Right.
Until Lincoln declared it.
Right.
At her constant lobbying.
There's a question from our chat room related to something you were just talking about. You know, you mentioned stuffing, and the chat room question is, when did we start stuffing bread into the turkey, and why is that still a tradition?
In ancient times. If it's hollow, stuff it is the rule here. would be any, that would be any bird, little ones, big ones, waterfowl, landfowl. If it's hollow, you stuff it.
Trey, would you agree with that?
Well, the dressing and the stuffing, mostly out of bread, was used to soak up a lot of the juices and the flavors that come out of it. That's, you know, that's why they, you know, stuff the cavity of the bird with, you know, breadcrumbs or rice or anything. It's just to kind of start to really absorb, you know, the juice, and then you pull it out, and then it has even more rich flavor, like a fortified, you know, turkey flavor.
Right. And so that, but that wasn't something they did at the original meal. I mean, there wasn't a huge amount of bread being eaten in 1621
probably
in America.
Probably not, you know, but if they had cornbread or, you know, if they had that dry corn or, you know, anything.
Yeah,
grains.
If they didn't, this is Sandy again, you know, if they didn't stuff it, they wish they could.
Yeah. Okay, I need to remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Famuliner, and today we're talking about the Thanksgiving meal, how we came to eat the things we do, and how that menu continues to evolve over time. Joining me in the studio, we have Marcia Vanderlip, food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, and Trey Quinlan, chef and owner of Trey Bistro here in Columbia. Also on the phone, we have Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher, both of them authors of books about the history of food. For those of you in our audience, we would love to hear in our final moments here a little bit of your traditions and how you think those might change in the future. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us, intersection@kbia.org, or you can also tweet us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. Carol, I wonder if you wanted to weigh in about, you know, some of these things that they might have liked to do, but they didn't, and eventually did wind up in our Thanksgiving meal as we know it today. Are there things that you know, the technology wasn't there yet, and so they just couldn't do it, or things that they might have done on a daily basis way back when that now...
I mean, they didn't know what they were missing, you know, as far as new products on the market or how to cook things. You know, I think it was just a gradual progression of being exposed to different ways of cooking, different products. You know, I think it was an evolution.
Okay. In terms of that evolution, we've mentioned already the, you know, the Southern influence as well. When did potatoes come in? Sweet potatoes, regular potatoes, all of that. Sandy, maybe you can help us with that.
Sure. Yeah, early 1700s for white potatoes, Irish potatoes, so-called. We got Scots-Irish settlers in New England in the early 1700s, and the mashed potatoes, a white potatoes period, worked their way into the diet, and they're so popular that people were eating them 2-3 times a day anyway. So, you know, they get trotted out for Thanksgiving as well.
Right.
People in England certainly knew sweet potatoes, and there was a version of a pie called a potato pie, which would be recognizable today as a sweet potato pie if you were in the South. That tradition just moves right to the South where the sweet potatoes grew. In New England, we took pumpkin and mashed it all up and treated it like sweet potatoes. That's how we get a pumpkin pie. Mm-hmm. But the mashed potato, you know, potatoes have been with us for, about 300 years.
Well, isn't the potato a New World crop that they got?
Yes.
And then they brought over to Europe,
yes.
Like sweet
that's
potatoes,
another, yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's
come
another
from
one.
South America.
It gets brought from the New World to the Old World,
and then brought back
again.
You know, brought back only modified.
Yeah.
Right. What about the things that used to be part of a meal like Thanksgiving and aren't anymore, like mincemeat? We don't eat that anymore.
What a shame.
I thought it was more Christmassy, but
I don't. This is Sandy. I love mincemeat, but I don't know. What about your other panelists?
Well, Carol, what do you think? Mincemeat as a part of the Thanksgiving meal?
Well, I grew up on mincemeat, but it was like homemade mincemeat, and I just always preferred raisin pie as to just the spices that are in mincemeat pie. I do have a friend that says she. She really enjoys mincemeat pie, but I don't think people make it much anymore.
Right. I suspect there are a lot of our listeners who don't even know what it is.
You know, the version you would buy now would be meatless, but when we made it on the farm growing up, it was made with
Sandy, would have been bits of pork.
Yeah, beef, venison. That's where, if venison pops on anyone's table, I mean, it might be some people still make traditional mincemeat using venison. Neck meat.
Right.
It's not at my table. I tried it growing up, and it didn't agree with me, so
well,
I guess I...
Yeah, this is Carol.
I'm missing out. I'm missing out.
Carol, go ahead.
I was just looking over Sarah's cookbook that was published originally in 1839, and she makes a comment about mince pie. She was really into eating healthy for her day, and she said mince pie should be only eaten at Thanksgiving and not later. And one other thing that would not have been on Sarah's table, and Sandy maybe can help with this, she would not have had hot rolls. She said bread should not be served.
That's bad for you. You shouldn't eat hot bread. That's right.
No hot bread for Sarah.
Wow. So she was trying to be healthy at Thanksgiving more so than on other
days. Well, she was trying to be healthy over the, but she, you know, that was just, Sandy, can you explain the hot bread? No hot bread?
You know.
I've
often suspected that rule against hot bread was so the cook wouldn't lose their meal before, you know, their bread baking before dinner time. You know how good hot bread is. You want to slather butter all over and wolf it right down.
Yeah, right.
The
hot bread's still releasing gas.
Tell them they can't have it till it's cold. That, you know, saves your supply. But actually, I think they were worried about vapors coming off that yeast that may have been a little too cold.
Yeah, that's what Trey was saying as well, right?
The yeast is still converting sugar into carbon dioxide still with the proofing. So, you know, it's still very much active, you know, pulling it straight from the oven.
Mm-hmm. Right. Interesting stuff. We have another caller on the line. Joanne from Columbia is on the phone. Joanne, are you with us?
I am.
Great. Thank you for calling in today.
I just had to get in on the cranberry sherbet conversation. I'm 82, and growing up, my mother always served what she called cranberry sherbet for Thanksgiving, and she made it with water. It didn't have milk in it, as I recall. I do have her recipe. So we kind of got out of the habit of serving that after she quit cooking Thanksgiving dinner. But a couple of years ago, I found a recipe for a cranberry orange sorbet in a ice cream book, and it is delightful. So I am going to start making that again and having that as a tradition.
Well, thanks.
Also, on your conversation about mincemeat, my 87-year-old sister brought me a jar of her homemade mincemeat the other day, so I'm going to have mincemeat pie, maybe not for Thanksgiving, but at least between now and Christmas.
Okay. All right. Well, Joanne, thank you so much.
That lucky
for...
woman.
Yeah, a real traditional meal that's going to take place there.
Real mincemeat with meat in it.
Well, fantastic. Well, Joanne, thank you for calling in and sharing your experience with us. I think there's going to be a frozen cranberry dish revival after the show or something. It seems the topic of the day, which is an interesting thing in terms of, you know, reinterpreting some of what goes on around our Thanksgiving and things that are old that are new again. Sandy, I wonder, are there things from the past that were associated with Thanksgiving that, you know, could potentially make a revival given the way that our society is shifting?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Well, I think one way that we're shifting is moving more towards fresh produce, which was more likely what they used back then, as opposed
seasonal.
To like in the 50s and between the 50s and 70s, a lot more canned green beans, canned, you know, sauces and stuff. But freshness with local markets, you know, even people buying locally raised birds is now a new thing that's now more available.
That's an interesting thing, though, because a lot of the green bean casseroles do not come from fresh green beans, right?
They do not.
Most don't.
Oh, but they're so good when they're fresh.
Dried, fried, onions on top.
Mm-hmm. And root vegetables, too. I mean, we use a lot of root vegetables for Thanksgiving. I don't know. They must have used carrots and parsnips and things like that. And we do a puree with that. I think those are so wonderful and cheap and good.
Yeah. A good question from our chat room. Will we see the demise of any other Thanksgiving foods in our generation, perhaps? Are any of these things going to go away like mincemeat went away? Trey, I'll let you weigh in on that first.
I think that bread is going to be going away. You know, people more and more having more difficulties with gluten just because of what we're doing, you know, with our grains, you know, with modifying wheat to the point where our bodies can't process it. So I think bread's going to be one of the first things to go.
What else do you stuff a turkey with if you're not going to have a bread-based stuffing?
Rice was a good alternative.
Are there other options?
Any type of grain, you know, or legume,
you know. Do cornbread, too. Cornbread stuffing. That'd be good.
Sandy here. There's a couple of really nice historic recipes involving a lot of mashed potatoes and onions all crammed into a bird.
Oh, yeah.
How would that work? You just mash up the potatoes and then it goes in with the onions?
Have you seasoned them? You season them and put in there onions that you have simmered and you've chopped all up. You know, if you did a 1-to-1 ratio of onion and potato, that'd be pretty yummy.
This is Carol. I have a question.
Yeah, please, Carol.
I think one thing that has gone by the wayside more is the actual stuffing of the birds. I think there are more stuffings offered as sides.
Dressing, right?
Yeah, at that point it's dressing, as Marcia pointed out.
Or it is, like, my mother-in-law she quit stuffing her bird years and years ago because she was worried with health issues, whether she got the temperature of it hot enough. But she, you know, put her stuffing around the base of the bird. You know, I don't see anybody I know stuffing birds.
Oh. Right, Marcia.
Am I off on that?
Yeah, we use a stuffing bag now too. You can buy them at the market so that you can check the temperature of the stuffing. If it's at 170 and you pull the bag out, and then you could also do it on the side if folks don't like the stuffing from the bird. But there would be a big rebellion, as I said, in my family if we didn't do it that way because it flavors the stuffing so
well.
What
about the deep frying of the bird? Marcia, do you think that's going to stick around, or is that going to make its way back out of the public mindset?
I would say don't do it if it's your first time on Thanksgiving.
I had two friends had it on a spigot. We're going to put it over the turkey burner in the pot, and they didn't allow enough room in the pot, so when they were submerging the turkey, oil went over the side, it shot up, big flame. Not pretty.
It's a good way to burn your house down.
Well, you do it outside the house.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Okay.
Well,
let that.
Too many horror stories.
Be careful if you're going to deep fry your turkey this year.
I hear it's delicious, though.
I think that's the last piece of wisdom we're probably going to be able to go with here before. I have to say that's it for today's Intersection. I'd like to thank our guests, Marcia Vanderlip, food editor for the Columbia Daily Tribune, Trey Quinlan, who is the chef and owner of Trey Bistro here in Columbia, Sandy Oliver and Carol Fisher, both of them authors of books about the history of food. Thanks to all of them for joining us today. We'd like to remind you and our audience that this program takes place for a full hour live every Monday from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. You can watch our live streaming video of the program each Monday afternoon online by going to kbia.org. Alongside that video, you could submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute. It is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Raymond Tungekar and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Caleb Hoke, Casey Morell, and Andrew Yost. Pat Akers is our audio producer, executive producers Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Thanksgiving and a good week.